Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, this is part two. Just to make clear, you may have missed part one, or maybe you're listening in the wrong order, or you've clicked the wrong button, but this is part two. If you haven't listened to part one, listen to part one first. I mean, it's not an incredibly structured chat, because none of us really did that, but it will probably help to know where we come from to get to this bit. So yes, if you haven't listened to part one, listen to part one now. If you have, this is part two. Enjoy.
Beautiful stuff.
Is that what you liked? Is that the sense of him being able to somehow be a respected stage actor and a very high status man, but also being a pure comedy at the same time?
I'm amazed by that, because that's where I'm driving, and it's very difficult to pull off. Because if you imagine the broadcasters, the producers, they want to put someone in who's going to draw a crowd, and they don't quite believe that anyone can draw both crowds. And it is a tricky thing to pull off. You're going to be in a drama and pull a big drama crowd. You're going to be in a comedy and pull a big comedy crowd. They're going to be the same crowd or different crowd. No one knows how that works. And I'm coming into contact with this all the time in doing dramas and films, and then doing very surreal comedy. And you know, Steve Carell is another one who's done that, and he's moved away from it. Hugh Laurie has moved away from the comedy. Mm. Steve Carell, I think, has moved away from comedy. I'm still doing them both, which is weird.
So in a way, you're admiring his strategy. You were talking about strategies, going, someone who's done something you don't even understand.
No, I would if that was his strategy. I don't think it was his strategy. He was offered that. He was doorstopped and said, look, here's a deal. And he said, okay, I'll do this. And he did it. What he did right was that thing I said about the bottom line of drama is to be truthful. He is always truthful to his character. He never breaks that character. And that is the key thing of drama. And I said this to Matt LeBlanc when I did a film with him. Do you guys in Friends, do you ever break character to get a laugh? And he said yes, but it's not a big crime. It's just that most comedians do it. If you think you can do this, you can do something that's a bit odd that doesn't really quite fit in with the character, but it will get a laugh, then we're so driven for the laughs, we're so hunter seeker for the laughs, that we will do that. Here's a thing that came up in, I was doing Day and the Death of Joe Egg, right? And
terrific play, isn't it?
It was a terrific play, and it has this bit where you've got three scenes which are improvised, right? Now usually an actor will then go and do improvise. I come from improvising and comedy, and the acting was my tough gig on that. But the comedy I could do standing on my head. I just knew this, and I could. But in between it, it's all about our daughter is mentally disabled and how serious that is. But we take her to a GP, we take her to a specialist, and then we go to see a vicar. So those are the three scenes. And the director, what I got right in New York, which I didn't get right in London, was the director said, don't forget, in between, if you're going into these crazy scenes, in between the scenes, bring it back, because keep one hand on the wheelchair, because this is real. Now, if you're mucking about, it's not the actors mucking about here, it's the characters mucking about here. So this was an interesting, and that's what John Lithgow always, he was always that guy from outer space with all the stakes of that. He was never John Lithgow.
All right.
No, I can't talk about it. It's too personal. Let's just say I had sex with Dr. Albright.
And that's amazing too, because he does. There are stunt scenes he's allowed in this where he's. There's a lovely thing where he's in a Japanese restaurant with Jane Curtin, who's playing the woman he loves.
Yeah.
And he's being the sushi chef, and he's chopping stuff up, and it's really over the top and really big, and it's almost like a dance. He's moving. Some of this big man's moving around the frame, and it's just pure clowning. But there's never any moment in that when he's not the character of Dick Solomon.
Yeah.
It's clearly something that they've gone, you can just cut loose here. And he's gone, I'll cut loose this far, but not.
No, I don't think it's the far thing. It's in a line. It's a line thing as opposed to a distance. He could go as big as he wanted. He could scream, he could shout, because he is essentially a baby. It is essentially, this child. So he can be as big as a baby wants to be. Whatever they want, but as long as it's stay on the same tram lines. Don't jump tram lines and go across. Stay, and that's truthful. And that would be his dramatic acting. I don't think he would want to. I don't think he'd think about that. Whereas if you come from a comedy basis, we would jump tram lines and reach for a gag that's not in our, which we're not allowed to do, which you shouldn't be allowed to do under story and character. Purposes, because like if you're doing character improv, it's all thumbnail characters. If you're doing stand-up, you're just going for whatever jokes you can get. I now try to stay more true to that, and if there's a joke there that doesn't fit how I'm playing it, I shouldn't say it.
So has your acting experience now affected how you do the scenes, the act-outs within your stand-up?
Yes, and also my diction is better, because I had this whole mumbling thing which I developed as a teenager where my brother's funny, my dad was funny, and I couldn't get a word in edgeways. I couldn't, at the dinner table, I found it difficult to tell a story. If I was telling a story, I would just be getting to, okay, now they're all listening. I'm almost getting close to the punchline, and, not even a funny, just a story that might be amusing. And then someone said, could you pass the salt? And we haven't got any salt. Why don't you go out and get salt? And suddenly this whole story was, and I now do things if I'm at a table. I say, I'm telling a story. Come back to the story. And I will force the story through. Or if some very nice waiting person comes up and says, now, are you all happy? I'm telling a story. Just getting to the punchline. Hang on a second. Because, but anyway, so I developed this mumbling thing. And that was a lack of confidence thing. And then I took it into the stand-up. So my early stand-up is full of like that. And in the drama, I needed to articulate. I needed to get the words out clearly. And sometimes you're doing it, Long John Silver, you're playing it. London or America, playing in the riches, and I had to stay in this accent the entire time. So I did that even off when I wasn't filming. I was staying in American, so I could just lock this thing down. So you want it real, and you want your diction right, and diction right for the character, and right for whatever accent you're doing. So that is a number of things from one side has helped in the other side. I don't know if anything from comedy has helped in the drama. Any dramas I do, I quite often I have one joke in the entire thing. Vague joke. There's one in Victoria and Abdul where I'm shooting at Nebworth and Judy Dench is up the stairs, is Queen Victoria, and I'm Edward the Seventh down the bottom of the stairs. And she says, I'm taking the Munchie, her Muslim friend / lover, I'm taking to Venice. And I say, the line is, you can't take a Muslim to Venice. And that's just nonsense. Lying. Why? And I thought it was like a funny, I mean, no one laughs at it. And I just think it's funny in my head. But I had that one joke. I had one joke in Treasure Island. But they're not even jokes. But I like that because I know in drama, what works is not what works in comedy. Actually, this is an interesting thing to say. When I went from comedy into drama, I knew that if people are struggling in drama, what they will do is they'll lean into doing a funny version of the scene, of the line, or whatever. So I had to turn all my comedy muscles off, put them all down to zero. Imagine a big mixing desk. It was all down to zip, pull all the faders down. And then I had nothing. So no comedy instincts were allowed to be used. So I realized I had no instincts. So my early work, if you watch any of my early work, it's rubbish. It's really dodgy, if not rubbish. But I had to do that. And that's why I want to talk about it now, because I had to train up my own instincts in full view of people saying, that guy's quite well known and he's doing this small role. And, ooh, he's not that. I don't know if I believe him. Yeah. And so I had to go through that rubbishy phase.
It's a very brave thing to do in the public spotlight.
Well,
to not choose to go for the thing you can do.
It had to happen. So yes, but what normally happens is you get abuse, and then you say, well, let's give it up. And it was in the Believe documentary we did. I said this to Sarah Townsend, I was directing. I said this journalist said, why does Eddie Izzard want to be a a so-so actor when he's a really good comedian. And I said, well, because I used to be a so-so comedian. It was this thing. I personally go through so-so, and I start off awful in loads of things that I do. Most people do, I think.
That's the one of the great truths about anything good, is that it went through a period of being bad. It's one of the things people don't like to hear. This is the first draft of everything is usually pretty poor.
Well, yeah, and people don't hear it and they don't believe it either, because, you know, there are some kids who are 15 and, hey, I did this one song and it took off, and they might be pretty good looking, and, well, you didn't work on your looks, did you? Because that all worked. So they'll just say, I think a lot of people who are coming to the creative area, they think, well, some, you know, if you're good, you're just good. But most people who can get really good start off not good. Or okay.
Not so bad that you completely give up.
Yeah. Well, that's it. The determination is more important than talent. That's the thing that I've worked out. That's kind of scary, but it seems to be true. Determination is more important than talent, because determination can pull talent out of you. And I think I was trying way too hard in my early auditions, you know, school auditions that you have. And also, if you're not very tall, if you remember at school, the tall boys got the lead king roles and the hero roles. And
this
the
is all Lithgow and John Cleese. This is being big.
Yeah. Yes,
big,
yes, maybe so. But even though one was doing drama and one was doing comedy, but the small boys would not get it. Small girls, I don't think that would count against them if you were. But I was also probably just reading my lines really loudly. See how loud I can read?
It's all about volume, isn't it?
Well, you don't know what. No one tells you anything when you're a kid. What is good at it? And the thing is, you have to try again. Robert, Bruce yourself.
I didn't realise that the show had been built around John Lithgow, but it makes perfect sense, because it's basically a concerto for John Lithgow and other people, isn't it? That's what it is, with him in the middle giving all the juicy solos.
Listen, it's 4-4 time with a half beat hesitation. We have to dance.
No, we don't.
Yo quiero bailar contigo. Porque sus ojos son el sol de mi corazón.
Allow me to translate using the universal language.
Oh, dance!
And they played to his strengths, and his strengths, he played to their writing. It just mounted.
There's a really noticeable thing that I don't think they knew, because the other guys around are good as well. It's a good ensemble cast.
Yeah,
it's a lovely,
very good.
Good sitcom family.
Find out what women on this planet do.
Well, why can't Harry do it?
Because you're the woman.
That brings up a very good question. Why am I the woman?
Because you lost.
They feel like a sitcom family. You feel like you've seen
French
this.
French Stewart is amazing, isn't he?
Peering through his eyelids the whole way through. But in a weird way that makes him look like Clint Eastwood. Like he's just trying to be sort of alpha male, but being complete Father Dougal idiot.
I can't see through my eyelids.
Open them.
Oh, they're manual.
And I like the blousy woman from downstairs who's... Yeah, sexy going on 60s.
It's so nice to have a tenant who smokes. So many people are giving it up. It just breaks my heart.
I've been all the way through them once, and I'm going back through it second time. But it's just, it's beautiful stuff.
If you watch them in order, one of the things I notice is it starts out and it's got that classic 90s, slightly laddie male gaze thing, especially about Kristen Johnston.
Yeah.
And basically at the beginning, she's just a pair of breasts and a pair of legs. And they go,
even though it's a guy playing.
It's a kind of, yeah, it's a guy inside. But it's very, very, everyone's talking about tits constantly. It's very, very 90s.
Lieutenant.
What?
Permission to speak freely.
Permission granted.
Sir, would you jump up and down for us?
Oh, yeah, and put your hands back behind your head like this.
I will not.
What? Please, for science, truly.
And then by about episode 6, they've completely dropped all that. And it gets a reputation for being quite broad and sort of sexy. She is completely allowed to be herself and has completely taken over the part, and they've just written it up to meet her. And I've got the feeling they maybe weren't expecting her to be as good as she was. Because by that point, the two of them sparring off each other just starts catching fire.
You don't have the responsibility I do. If we let him out of that box and the big giant head gets wind of it, who do you think's going to take the fall, huh? The information officer? The transmitter? I don't think so. It's going to be me, the woman. Typical.
Sally!
Think of all we've been through together. When Brad dumped you, who ordered you to drink yourself silly? Until you completely drowned your feelings for him.
You did.
And when I ran over your foot with the car, who drove you to the hospital the very next day?
You did.
And when you were hungry that day in the park, who stole that little girl's ice cream cone?
Tommy did that.
Well, it was my idea.
It was.
And also her love interest, the gentleman who's also in Seinfeld.
Wayne Knight.
He plays
Newman, isn't he?
Yes, he plays Newman, and he's great in this, and it's a real... And he's going, wow, my girlfriend is just off the charts, and I didn't expect to have this girlfriend. So that's a beautiful thing. They play that one backwards and forwards, and he really anchors that and changes the dynamic of what everything's...
Well, they can do all these silly jokes about, sort of, because they're not really who they look like, so the idea that the kid is actually the oldest one of the aliens.
Yeah.
And that lovely line was, why do I get to be the woman? Because you lost.
Yeah.
And it's either they've been tossing coins on the spaceship on the way over, and this is a sexist world they're landing in, so she loses, so she gets to be the woman. They're playing all these neat, slightly Simpsons-y cartoon jokes on top of an American 90s in front of an audience sitcom.
Yeah.
And it gets to be both those things. So it gets to be big and broad, but have this wonderful dramatic actor in the lead and probably proving that thing that people always say, that sort of comedy is hard. So you need an expert to do it. Someone really, really good.
But you wouldn't have said that he would be the expert, though.
Yes. What you've got there as well, which is quite neat, which is a pomposity in the character and also, weirdly, a pomposity in the actor himself to go... that he's playing high status in the real world as well. So basically they've had to trick him into doing this in a funny sort of way, which is almost like a sitcom in itself. Like, how did this happen? How did John Lithgow end up in a sitcom full of sort of slightly big, daft, clowny jokes? It's great.
Yeah.
He's obviously having a bloody good time as well, isn't he?
Maybe that's the secret. They promised him a bloody good time.
Yeah, I was watching an interview with him in which he described the show as being extravagantly fun. And he also mentioned in the same interview, he said, when I'm doing film acting, I keep getting told to turn it down. And I think the subtext of that was that no one said that to him on this show at all. So he could just turn it up as much as he liked, whenever he liked.
Once you've
got that freedom, you actually control it, don't you?
Yeah.
So you go, well, I'll turn it up, but I'll leave it for special
But what
occasions.
You were saying about control, that's something that has never occurred to me, is that you can turn it up as long as you don't go left or right. You can go as high as possible. And that's a real actor's skill. Is it him saying, I can turn this up to absolute full and I will never left or right.
He's never going to, because that's his actor's training. And a comedian probably would get tempted to walk over the lines. But he never would, because he'd be so locked in. I just don't think he would consider that. Whereas if you come from comedy, you would consider it.
Sacrifice anything.
Yes, yeah, so sacrifice anything, story, logic, thing. Who's it wrote Only Fools and Horses?
John Sullivan.
John Sullivan. He talked about that in Story. Don't go for a laugh, it's breaking character. I mean, that's the first time I'd heard anyone talking about it. I thought, right, okay. So, yes. And I started analyzing, because I use all this. Because when I came out as transgender, did I say this already? Mm-hmm. That I self-analyzed?
Yeah.
It's like lying on a bed thinking about... Oh, yes, I did say that. So that's when I got analysis, because I did self-analysis. And then I was doing street performing, and I couldn't get the show working. And street actually taught me everything. That's ninja training. Street is the hardest thing in the world of any medium that I think exists.
Were you an escapologist? Did I read that somewhere?
But we started off, me and my partner Rob Ballard, we started off as a double act. And then I became an escapologist, went solo in 87, became an escapologist. And then I from Ropes and Chains, and then I got on a 5-foot unicycle and escaped from manacles. But it was so hard. I rewrote the show. He went on a holiday for a break, and I said, look, I'll rewrite the show. When you come back, I made it worse. And we just couldn't get it going because the attention spans change. Attention spans for adults become children become animals. That is the weird thing. You cannot talk. You can't do a scene saying, if you imagine two people walking on the street at Covent Garden or any open space where there's people walking around, they're saying, hi, I'm a dentist. You want to see? Yes, I want to see a dentist. I've got a problem with it. They won't watch that. You have to do physical situation comedy. This is how I analyzed it. So the situation comedy, it's physical. It's got to be, I'm going to get onto a unicycle. I'm going to get onto a ladder. I'm going to do the thing. We're going to balance this kid. I'm going to jump over the kid and juggle. You've got to be doing something active. I need someone from the audience. You really need an audience member. That really does help, because then all the audience will root for that audience member. Mm. Oh, he's really going for it, this guy. Oh, well done, mate. And that it was so difficult, because people would walk off in the middle of the show. Of course they would, because they can get a coffee, a film, a thing, let's go shopping. They're not there for any reason. So I thought this would be easy. I thought 2 weeks, because I'd done three Edinburgh shows by that time when I got down to Covent Garden at 85. And And I thought, I can do comedy, I can do sketch stuff, I can play characters with voices like this. Oh, characters with voices like this, I can do that. And this looks really easy because I've done a bit of it at the Edinburgh Festival where there's tons of people, so of course it was easy. And I thought the rules would apply, but no, people just wander away. And and you're there talking with people just walking around you like an idiot. And so I lost all my confidence. I went down to complete zero. You know, some acting schools, they say, we're going to break you down and build you up.
Yeah,
Marines,
yeah.
We're going to break you down and build you
thing,
up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I accidentally broke myself down into pieces and accidentally, I couldn't think of anything else to do. Strategy-wise, I couldn't work out what else I could do. I didn't. Stand-up was beginning to was happening and I wasn't doing it. Was it beginning to happen? It was beginning to happen. And I just wasn't, but I'd never thought of myself being a stand-up. So this street thing, I just said, let's just keep doing it because I can't think of anything else to do. And gradually, I remember a bit, I started to get a sense of my own voice. This is a thing that I thought the Americans were better at performing in their own voice. And in Britain, we were better. And these are generalized rules that we were better characters.
Yeah.
We had more character-driven stuff had come from us. And Eddie Murphy was one of the few who could do himself. And then he could do these weird characters as well. But I didn't know his Saturday Night Live stuff at that point. But I thought, I analysed, I've got to get to play myself. I have to be able to work in my own voice. Not just, I am the king of China. Or, yeah. I am not the king of China.
Those are the two characters. They come as standard.
These are the only two I did. Or, you know, just anything. I was postman a thing with big voices, small voices. But then just to play myself, I thought, what's funny in that? And you can see this with a number of comedy people who play a lot of characters. They're not very happy in their own skin.
Mr. Peter Sellers thing. Mm. There's no one there.
Yes.
He said.
Yeah, and I'm very happy because I developed this thing. Because I fought to get it. And me and Rob used to start at the beginning of a show at Covent Garden. You don't start the show. You lay out all your props so it looks like something's going to happen. And then you just start talking. And he would be front stage left and I would be front stage right. There's no stage. It's just cobbles.
Mm.
And so we started doing, at the beginning, this sort of 10 minutes of trying to build up a little edge. And we were doing it on our own. And I realized after a while, I was getting this thing. I just kept talking and talking. I found if I just kept talking, saying, hi, we're going to do a show. It's going to be here. We're going to, children will have a bad time in the show. So no children, please. If you have them, throw them into the bin. Not good, but we will do a show. Well, it would be an amazing show. It could be people. I remember Che Guevara, he said to me, you know, I would just say anything. And if I kept it going, I could hit funny. And if I stopped, then you'd go into panic. So I just kept talking and talking and talking. And I found after a while, I remember thinking the spring of 86, I think probably spring of 86. And I say, I'm beginning to get something here. I could feel this voice. And I thought, this voice is key. And I wasn't thinking of stand-up. I had no belief of ever. Billy Connolly did great stand-up. That was for him. I cannot do stand-up. I was quite sure of that. And then I got the street and I went solo 87 and then 88. I started from 87 to 88. I was doing the solo stuff, just Ropes and Chains. And I thought, I've got to do stand-up. And people saying, you should do stand-up. And I thought, yeah, that is, because became the mother load. Then weird, because sketches were nowhere. And then sketches came back on telly, Fast Show, I think.
And Little Britain and things like that.
Yes, yeah. And it was just nowhere. And I thought, well, it's stand-up as well. If you do stand-up, you're the only person. You don't have to make deals. You don't have to sit down and work out with yourself what you want to do. You just decide what you want to do. So, because I was in a four-person comedy group back at Sheffield Uni, and we were, Sheffield University Fringe, Suff Theatre Company, and you've got four people, just like Python, they have to have five people now deciding, what are we going to do? We're going to do a show, we're going to not do a show, or bands or Rolling Stones, when we're going to tour, what dates we're going to tour. When you're one person, you just say, I'm doing this now, then I stop that, we're going to put that there, we're going to do this, I'm going into politics right now.
But again, that suits your strategy thing, the idea of, I've thought this through.
It makes it easy.
Yeah, then you don't have to be in negotiation about your strategy. You go, I think I know what I want to do.
Well, I had all this planning, and so all the strategy is always, because I had to say, right, hold that there, we're going to go to New York now. New York, yeah, I need to get someone to put me on in New York. That would be the way forward. And that was.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It was interesting to hear you talk about why you picked John Lithgow as well, as someone who is not doing the same thing as you, but is doing something absolutely brilliantly, and that by looking at them and by admiring them and enjoying them, you can not necessarily copy them, but to appreciate what they're doing. The way you talked about it, I've not heard someone say that about an actor, is that literally to draw that geography of performance. And it's clearly something you obviously think about a lot, but by looking at someone who is excellent,
yeah.
Do you draw inspiration from them or ideas? Or?
Yeah, well, particularly dramatic acting. I love dramatic acting. My work is, I mean, you know, I was in, as I say, I'm bringing back to Victoria and Abdul, but me and Judy Dench just being head to head. And I worked, if anyone watches that film, which I think is, I love the film and just great to work with Judy, and I've done another film with her since then. But I worked out the one angle that Eddie Seven had was he hated his mum and he wanted her to go because she'd been on the throne a long time and he wanted to be king. And she was, you know, pegging out and that was going. And then she meets this Indian guy and she's got a new lease of life. And he's pissed off. And, you know, he's just really angry about it. And he's the one character in the film who could tell mum to fuck off. And so I realized that was my thing. This is not a comedy thing at all. This is a character thing. And I thought, if mum comes in, if everyone stands up, I'm going to sit down. If they stop talking, I'm going to start talking. If whatever I do, I'm just not going to. If she gives me a hard time, I'll just give her a hard time back. I'm just not going to. That was the interesting thing in him. That's what you're looking for.
But that command of character will allow an audience to enjoy the character and your performance because they can say, oh, this is by getting down to the essence of what someone is and identifying it. What you're describing there is not only dramatically accurate, but also very funny, because you're going, if everyone stands up and you sit down, you're not going for a comic beat. You're going for the truth of character. But weirdly, that's a little bit what Lithgow's doing, in that he's completely occupying the character. But the accidental consequences of that is that you go, this is very either dramatic or very funny.
Well, I think what I did in Victoria and Abdul could be funny in the right circumstances, but because the story is not being driven in that way, it isn't, and it goes to a very dark place. It's not, but the beats of comedy and drama, they're not too far away, because they're somewhere up there. It's very faint and difficult to see, but you know, black comedy is tragedy, is drama. You know, they actually can link together, but I am not thinking. I've trained myself to basically to drive a car and to ride a bicycle, or drive a car and fly an airplane. Two different things. They are related. Certain
maybe things. That's what's interesting is that the scene you were describing there. Literally, if you'd imagine a scene where someone, just because they hate their mum so much, does the opposite, could be played for laughs. But the idea hadn't occurred to you, or you went, oh, no, not in this world.
Yeah,
that's very interesting to sort of say that the drama, the reality of the character is so real that your comic sensibilities are turned off to an extent that you wouldn't go, ah, there's a laugh here.
Yeah, I absolutely, that is, and I'm not worried about it anymore. And I can sit there and just, I know where the, because in comedy, I know what I'm looking for, the edges. I know where, and I've trained myself in that, and I've now trained myself in drama to say, what are the edges of the scene? What can I do in this scene that only make it bounce out without throwing the other person as well? Because you can't make it, you know, I don't think, some people do, but some actors do, but I don't think it's right that you trip up the other actor. You're just, you want to work with them and give them something, give, you know, there's a whole scene I have with Judy where I say, I'm gonna have you committed, you know, to you, have you down as insane. And if I had to thump that into her, I had to really bash that into Judy. And if I did, then that would give her the ammunition that bash it right back at me. It's the tennis. More I did it, yeah, it's tennis, and she grand slams it back to me with this big speech, and that I knew that was there, so I just had to pile drive this in, and then she could pile drive it back to me. And it had this camera was huge, the lens was huge, it was this massive thing right in front of my eye. I couldn't even see Judy, because quite often you're acting, and you'll have just an X or a little dot or something, say that's where she is in real life. And I'm not talking to her, I'm just talking to, she's just behind the camera. So it's, but you train yourself to do all these things. It's weird, you get, because in stand-up, you're just on the stage and I play like it's in your own bedroom and these people just happen to have come in. And in, on film, you have to ignore all the cameras and the things and the grips and people adjusting the focus. And I do remember when those cameras used to freak me out. And the screaming, you know, the shouts of the first AD, all right, lock it down, let's go roll cameras, getting ready for that, which I now ignore all of that.
It's almost a way of getting everyone tense.
It did seem. And Clint Eastwood plays against this by saying, and go and stop in your own time, you know, when you want to. And then there's other people. I was just watching James Cameron because he gets really into doing his films on Terminator. You know, my tastes are very much not what people might, you know, it's action movies. I just know them quite encyclopedically. And so I was going through Terminator 2 and Schwarzenegger talking about him and saying that when he gets in the film, he's just very focused on the film. And he's saying, I heard him say action, you know, because he would say action like you do, like most. But Clint Eastwood said, no, that's not what's key. It's just say go. Just start when you want, because just trying to get those real moments.
Different rhythms, different textures, different feel on the set.
Yes, and whatever works, you know, for the director or the actors or however it is. But I do love, film is my first love. I broke into Pinewood Studios at 15. So
really?
Did you? Yeah.
Well, you see, this is my analysis. I was analysing from an early stage. This is in the, if you read the biography, there's the first, I'll tell you, the first line I got was, I was seven. And I was trying to do, and I decided I wanted to act, and or I liked it, liked the idea of doing this. And it was Beauty and the Beast, and I was down as a street urchin with another bunch of, I think we were obviously the useless kids. So Beauty, you're playing Beauty, you're playing Beauty's dad, you're playing the Beast, you're playing the guy from the SES who comes in, or whatever it is. You know, a number of people got characters, and you eight kids, you're useless. You have one group line. Remember the group line from childhood? Yeah. Oh, beauty, don't go. Oh, beauty, don't go. So this was, oh, beauty, don't go. And I know I was seven, and I know I did this, and I thought, these kids are a bit dozy, but I'm not so dozy. So when the cue comes, well, I wonder what the street urchins think. I just jumped forward and said, oh, beauty, don't go. And they were just inhaling breath, getting ready for the line. And I'd said it very quickly. Ah, well, the spokesperson for the street urchins feels that you should not go beauty. But I think you should go beauty. Otherwise, this story is about a young girl who doesn't go anywhere and there's a beast on a hill and no one knows anything about it. That's not good story technique. So off you go. So that was my first solo line, which I stole. And I was working things out. Anyway, so I worked out films exist. Films exist. I love films. Films exist. Those are people in films. Okay, the people are in film. This is pre, you know, coming out. So I'm doing basic analysis at this point. People, there's a real people. They're not just gods who live in the film, television thing. So they must make them somehow. They make them. Oh, there's credits at the end. This is the 70s, and there's no stop. There's no videos freezing.
Pause it.
So I sat in front of TVs with a notepad and just copied out as key grip. What's key? I don't know what that means. The gaffer, I don't know what that means. Says producers. Okay, these are producers. Who's that? What's his name? I was copying down names and things. And at the end of Battle of Britain, you can see it. Who gets what credit at what time is obviously a deal that they cut out. And at the end of Battle of Britain, it says shot on location in Spain and in Britain. And at Pinewood Studios, Ivor Heath Bucks. And it's a big one, single card, which is unusual. That studio thing usually comes right at the end. This was up front, so before everyone's got up and paid popcorn, you know, and said, "I'm going to the toilets now." At the end of the film, you're going to see that before you go, because there must have been financial things and whatever. And I copied that down. Pinewood Studios, Ivor Heath Bucks. That's where I have to go. So where's that? And so using the non-internet method of going to, I think, W.H. Smith, saying, do you have maps? And they got maps. And they got, you got one of you that got all the towns and cities of the entire UK in there. And they did. Alphabetically, they used to have them alphabetically, every single thing. Because otherwise, how did you find it? And I went through it, and Ivor Heath, okay, so that is the name, that's a village, that's a town, that's a village, I don't know, and it's there, and I took a train from Bexhill-on-Sea to London, took a tube to Uxbridge, took a bus to Ivor Heath, got out at a roundabout, I remember saying, is it Pinewood Studios? Yeah, it's half a mile down here. So walked down, Palmer Studios. There's a big gabled entrance, used to be the main entrance. And I thought, okay, now what do I... Right, I don't have this... I'm not sure how to do this bit. So I just went up and said, I'm going to work in films, and can I come in? Because I'm going to work in films. And they... I don't know what they said. I've said that they said, fuck off, kid. Or piss off, or just go, no, whatever. They did not entertain me. But I've got this map, and there's the Battle of Britain, and there's... No, just... go or we will kill you with our thoughts, you know. So I thought, I've come too far. So I thought there must be another entrance. And the second entrance, which is now the main entrance, was very close to the main entrance. So I walked up and then I went into Eagles Dare mode, where they watch the entrance into Schloss Adler and they just watch people walking in and out. And then Clint Eastwood and Richard Burton walk across, speaking obviously fluent German, except it's English. And said, what was her name? The thing. So they're officers chatting so they can get through without having their passes checked. And I'd noticed that if you watch that entrance, it's not the same these days. But some people were showing passes and some people were just walking in, some people were driving in. You know, it was if you could have the chutzpah.
It's the modern, we were talking about this just before the podcast. If you're wearing a high-vis jacket, you can walk in almost anywhere. If you look like you're meant to be there.
The high-vis jacket thing. So I did the high-vis attitude, jacket equivalent of attitude. So I walked in and I said in one version of my stand-up that I crept around and I realized, I didn't. I walked at a certain speed. I walked quite fastly. I walked, you know, there's a certain brisk speed. And
don't stop me.
Yes, don't, because if I'd known about Stanley Kubrick, and I'm after Stanley wants his sandwiches on a rye bread, don't stop me. Mr. Kubrick will be very annoyed. That would have been great to use. But anyway, I was in, and then I had to keep moving at that speed, and I walked around Pinewood Studios quite fastly for 2 hours, waiting for someone to say, you, stop moving so fast. Come and be this kid whose lead in this film is dead. It just exploded. You can be the lead. Yes, because that was what you'd heard, that, you know, I didn't know how to get into the film. And I went up to the Bond stage. I went all around.
Wow. Did you go onto the sound stages?
I didn't. I could hear people talking in the Bond stage. And I thought, if I go in there, then they'll find me. It should have been the last thing I did, that when, okay, you're going to get turfed out. But even at 15, I would have thought that could have been a black mark against me, and then I'll never be in the film industry again. But I could hear them on the other side of the door, and I wanted to go in. But even if I'd gone in, there would probably be somebody, what, can I be Bond? No.
If they said yes, and that's how I am.
Just for a minute.
No, you wanted
just
to
that's how I got here today.
You wanted to swim. I mean, it worked for Spielberg.
He had a fake office or something.
Which I've heard David Geffen say, I don't think that story is quite true. Because he did.
It's too brilliant to be true, surely.
I think some of it's true. I don't know. He said that, if you look at the Spielberg documentary, that I do think he definitely got off the Universal tour, hid in the toilet so they'd gone and mooched around. I do think he found an office. I don't know whether that led to him taking off or not. I think it's probably his film. He was making all these Super 8 films, and
that's the more normal way, in is to actually do the thing you're going to do.
But getting it through to the right people was so hard. You know, it was.
But there is a magic to that, and I completely sympathise with that. I'm growing up thinking, I want to be at the places where these things are made. There's a magic to them, and those cards at the end. The idea that those things were happening near you. You were in Britain and Star Wars. And
fairly near, yes. And the Star Wars, they're happening. I broke it at Elstree Street as well. I got immediately thrown out.
Yeah.
But
it's a magic thing that you go, but part of my, again, you're talking about strategies and things. You go, well, hang on, I need to be where the battle is happening, at the front line. I need to be somewhere where I can see the generals working.
I tried to get into Tiz Wars. No, into what was the one after Tiz Wars? OTT. Yeah. I tried to get that because when I went to Sheffield University studying accounting and financial management with mathematics, my long degree course, and there's a lot of Birmingham guys up there who say, oh, we're going to watch Tiz Wars now. And do you know Tiz Wars?
Yeah.
So they're watching Tiz Wars, and I was going, what's Tiz Wars? The morning, but why am I watching? Oh, wow, this is good. Then they started OTT, which is the evening version.
Yeah,
and I thought,
naughty Tiz Wars.
And I'd heard a story, which is a true story, where Peter Sellers, excellent imitator of people, had phoned up a producer and said, imitating two writers who he must have met. And he said, Hello, doing this. Hello, is that Jerry? This is Kenny Stevens here. And we're here with Frankie. Hi, Frankie. This young man, Peter Sellers. Is Peter Sellers? Yeah, it's Peter Sellers. Do recommend him. I think you should have a look and put him in your shows. All right. Well, okay. If you do both, you know, I trust you as writers. If you think. And he said, actually, no, I am Peter Sellers, and I'm just impersonating that, just showing what I can do. So, Prince, will you see him? And apparently, he saw him and put him in a thing. So I thought I'd do that, even though I couldn't impersonate anyone. So I went to phone Chris Tarrant. I've told this story to Chris Tarrant, who went, and didn't react to it. But I went down to, I hitchhiked from Sheffield to Birmingham, got off at Spaghetti Junction, interestingly, which you can, I walked, the guy said, we're going the wrong way off here. So I walked off a motorway. And there was, as I remember, a bus stop at the bottom, which doesn't make any sense. So there must have been off the slipway, there was a bus stop. And I took a bus into the centre. They had just changed over the phone systems from the bip, 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 bip type phone, which is obviously a payphone, into you could load up money, more international ones. You could put money in and then you wouldn't hear these pips. You could just keep your 10p's in there. It would hold a few. So there were two of those phones in the whole of Birmingham. And I got into one of them and just sort of sat in it, phoning up to try and talk to him, Chris Tarrant, to be able to try and pretend to be his agent. So I was trying to talk to his agent first. So I phoned up to talk to his agent, and he's in London. She said, yeah, he's in London, I'm afraid. He's not coming. Will he be back? No, yeah, he's supposed to be back. So I was waiting all day. 4 o'clock, is he back? No, he's not coming back. 5 o'clock, he's not coming back. No, he's not, he can't make it back today. So I can't even listen to the guy's voice. So I'm now going to do an impersonation of someone I've never heard. To Chris Tarrant. And so I got as far as, there's the OTT office. So I get through to, can I speak to Chris Tarrant, please? Who's that? Is Harold Stevens. Oh, hello, Harold. It's Shirley here. Hello, Shirley. which Harold Stevens is this? Damn. That was it. But I was, you know, I was really trying to get into things. I wanted David Putnam. I was obsessed with David Putnam's movies and him. And I just thought, if I could just get myself to the set and be on, you know, sweeping up. And then from sweeping up, you can get to T-Boy, and then you can get, you know, is a way. That is a way. It isn't necessarily the direct way. And I never could.
What you're talking about there is it's the perfect blend of drive, as you sort of said. You need drive, talent.
Determination is more important than
drive, and then just cunning. Drive and kind of blind, stupid cunning.
Well, the military tactic is attack, pull back, regroup, attack, pull back, regroup, attack, change of plan,
it's
change
a war of attrition.
Change the tactics. No, it's a war of persistence. It's actually, it's Grant at Vicksburg. It's Ulysses S. Grant at Vicksburg. It's just, you just try plan A. Okay, plan B. Okay, plan C. Okay, plan D. Plan E, plan F. It does get tiring out there. And you just, okay, go back to plan B. B with a bit of C in it. Okay. And plus, you know, just keep trying. And then something takes, you know, which was, I could feel the stand-up taking.
Was there a feeling that it could have been anything?
What?
If any of those things had worked, if you would...
Of those three comedies?
Of anything.
It was all in the comedy initially, the drama. Only when the stand-up started taking off that I thought, this is happening. Now, if I get too well-known as the comedy guy who has these crazy things with cats and ducks with guns...
It'll close the other doors.
It'll close the doors. So hold it down now. I think I'm doing interesting stuff now and in drama. So I had to pull the drama up. And then I knew I was going to politics. And if the momentum, critical momentum of your drama and your comedy is enough, you can go away into politics and come back without... You can put your career into hibernation as opposed to shoot it in the head.
Can I ask a seemingly daft question?
What?
Are you enjoying it? Are you having fun? Where you are, basically, this long thing, which is obviously involving so many different variables and things. Are you having fun?
Yeah, I don't want to go to politics, but I feel I have to because I believe in the world. I believe in humanity.
Where on earth do you get all your stamina from? I was just reading. I started to read a little bit a couple of days ago about that stretch you did of, you'll tell me how many marathons. Was it 37 in 41 days or something?
43, 51 in UK and 27, 27 in...
I just got tired reading about it.
South America, yeah.
Where do you get that
South
kind
America,
of stamina?
South Africa. I think it's built in. I think that
really?
I just had... Well, I had the determination, but I also had this dream, which is kind of a madness until the dream starts to work. And I thought, you've got to protect this little cocoon you believe you can do something. I thought I could do something could work around the world, but it wasn't working when I was 7, it wasn't working when I was 8, it wasn't working when I was 10, when I was 12, when I was 14, when I was 15. 15, I did a play that got some laughs. Things began to work, and then I thought, right, I'm definitely going to do this. I have to go to university because there's a certain pressure. But I'm just going to do shows like crazy when I got there, and everything else was just pushing. And at times, you know, it just I didn't think it. I thought it would take a year or 2 years. Mm. Most of Python were performing on television about 25. I think Michael Payne is the youngest, and I think he was in things at 25, maybe even 24. I didn't get anywhere until I was 30. So, but that's my strength now. The wilderness years are actually your stamina training years, and so that's why I could do that and go to the marathons and then do politics and then hopefully come out of politics and carry on.
Is that the energy that I imagine doing something like politics is going to require an enormous amount of energy? Yeah. When I look at politics now, it just looks exhausting. Even reading about it, it's like reading about marathons. It's just it looks like an exhausting thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's...
Well, curiously, we were talking to a friend of ours who's a political editor, and he was saying, basically MPs are so tired. They're so tired now because not only are they seem to have been in this struggle now for, what is it, 3 years or something with nothing happening, with lots of effort being made, but also they're now under constant abuse from all sorts of different directions, and it's really getting to a lot of them. It's affecting their mental health.
Mm. Everyone's just tired.
It is tough.
Is that why you have to do it? Because it needs to...
Well, I train myself for a fight. I'm very positive about Britain, about our country, about our continent, about our world. I've played in 45 countries. I'm performing in 4 languages. I believe this. I've said this a number of times. This is 21st century is a coming of age century for humanity. I think we're just lucky enough to be here. There's no one overlooking us from up in the clouds. We know that. World War II sort of proved that. It's up to the goodwill of men and women. And so this century will either make it a fair world for 7.5 billion people, or I think we're going to wipe ourselves off the planet if we continue with this lying Brexit hate, Trump hate kind of thing. So I like, you know, I've worked hard to get my thing going, my career going, which is great, but that doesn't really help any other people. I want to be positive. I want everyone should have the right to have a fair chance in life. So I'm going to go and fight for that. If Donald Trump's going to say, grab every woman by the vagina, all Mexicans are rapists. If he's going to lie so much that he's lied more than Hitler now, I just think this has got to be fought. And young people are getting up and fighting now. And it's the young at heart. So we've got to fight this thing. The idea that we go back to where we were, 1930s politics, let's try that again. It's just insane. Everything that Churchill believes his dream was the United Countries of Europe. So I'm going to go and fight for that. And we've got to learn to live together, work together in some shape or form. Otherwise, there's 7.5 billion of us and we're not going to make it. So I'm going to go and fight.
That's a blend of incredibly high stakes and incredibly high hopes, which is actually quite a nice thing to hear.
Well, I was a young person, the person 19 years old, was saying, if you talk to young people, I've campaigned to young people a lot before, and they put me there because I'm transgender, and it kind of relates in a certain way because it doesn't look like you're very old establishment. Mm. But they also, young people will not react to, well, your pension's going to be good, the price of housing, the thing. They don't really react to that. They want people with a vision of the future. My vision is everyone has the right to have a fair chance in life, enough security, enough democracy, the chance that their kids will have a better life than them. And we all have to be, getting to that place for everyone. And in our country, we have to be getting places where, as the time goes on, people will have a better, working people struggling, they want to get their money. They don't want to listen to a lot of politics, but they want to have a decent life. They want to retire. They want to have a decent holiday. I believe pulling out of our central trading market is just such a bad idea. And, you know, they were against austerity, but someone told them austerity was part of Europe, and that it wasn't. That was come from the subprime market, which is very rich and greedy people who tend to be right-wing people. So there's all this twisted stuff has come out. So I'm going to fight for. And young people, they say, we want to be part of our continent. It's our continent. Why should we go and hide ourselves from our continent and stick our heads in the ground? So that's what I'm going to fight for.
That sounds like a brilliant thing. And that is a beautiful place, I think, to finish. What a lovely, lovely sentiment to end on. Thank you for coming in and talking to us. It's been so lovely.
Eddie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
No problem.